In the novels of E.L. Doctorow, historical figures and fictional characters inhabit the same stories. In his best-known book, Ragtime, Freud, Emma Goldman, Henry Ford, and Harry Houdini make appearances. Dutch Schultz is one of the main characters in Doctorow's new novel, Billy Bathgate. Billy is a teenager from the Bronx who works for the famed gangster. The novel is set in New York in 1935. Ann Tyler reviewed the book for the New York Times and said Billy was a wonderful new addition to the ranks of American boy heroes. She described Doctorow as serving as a sort of human time machine, carrying his readers back to the days of the Wild West in Welcome to Hard Times, to the early 20th century in Ragtime, and to the 1930s in Loon Lake, World's Fair, and now Billy Bathgate. Three of Doctorow's novels have been made into films, Welcome to Hard Times, Ragtime, and The Book of Daniel, which was loosely based on the lives of the children of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. I asked E.L. Doctorow to read the opening of his new novel, Billy Bathgate.
Okay, the very first sentence I wrote in Billy Bathgate is the first sentence that appears in the book, and it actually delivered the character of Billy to me. He was sort of built into the diction and the syntax, and even the rhythm of the sentence gave me the way he breathed. Billy is a 15-year-old boy in the Bronx in the 1930s who attaches himself to the great Dutch Schultz, the Prohibition and post-Prohibition New York gangster killer. And the book opens with Billy leaping aboard a tugboat where Mr. Schultz is taking one of his henchmen, Bo Weinberg, en route to a ritual drowning in New York Harbor. And this is the way the book begins. He had to have planned it because when we drove onto the dock, the boat was there and the engine was running, and you could see the water churning up phosphorescence in the river, which was the only light there was because there was no moon nor no electric light either in the shack where the dockmaster should have been sitting, nor on the boat itself, and certainly not from the car. Yet everyone knew where everything was, and when the big Packard came down the ramp, Mickey the driver braked it so that the wheels hardly rattled the boards. And when he pulled up alongside the gangway, the doors were already open, and they hustled Bo and the girl upside before they even made a shadow in all that darkness. And there was no resistance. I saw a movement of black bulk, that was all. And all I heard was maybe the sound someone makes who is frightened and has a hand not his own over his mouth. The door slammed and the car was humming and gone and the boat was already opening up water between itself and the slip before a thin minute had passed. Nobody said not to, so I jumped aboard and stood at the rail, frightened as you might expect, but a capable boy, he had said that himself. A capable boy, capable of learning, and I see now, capable of adoring, worshipping, that rudeness of power of which he was a greater student than anybody. Oh, and that menace of him, where it might be all over for anyone in his sight from one instant to the next. That was what it all turned on. It was why I was there. It was why I was thrilled to be judged so by him as a capable boy. The danger, he really was a maniac. Besides, I had that self-assurance of the very young, which was in this case the simple presumption I could get away when I would, any time I wanted. I could outrun him, outrun his rage or the rage of his understanding and the reach of his domain, because I could climb fences and hustle down alleys and jump fire escapes and dance along the roof parapets of all the tenements of the world if it came to that. I was capable, I knew it before he did, although he gave me more than confirmation when he said it. He made me his. But anyway, I wasn't thinking of any of this at the time. It was just something I had in me if I could use if I had to. Not even an idea, but an instinct waiting in my brain in case I ever needed it. Or else, why would I have leapt lightly over the rail as the phosphorescent water widened under me, to stand and watch from the deck as the land withdrew and a wind from the black night of water blew across my eyes, and the island of lights rose up before me as if it were a giant ocean liner sailing past and leaving me stranded with the big, murdering gangsters of my life and times.
And that's E.L. Doctorow reading from his new novel, Billy Bathgate. Now, you said the voice came to you with that first sentence. And when I opened your book, the first thing I thought was how different this voice was from the usual staccato, hard-boiled style associated with crime writing and, you know, with gangster figures in American fiction.
Well, I don't think of this as crime writing. And I've never been a particularly fond of the so-called hard-boiled school of work. I've never been that much interested in crime fiction or true crime, or nor have I followed the culture of professional criminals in the papers. I think of this as the story of a young man's sentimental education. It's a kind of Bildungsroman. He's a bright, enterprising kid, the ideal. He's curious, he's energetic, he has a lot of wonder for the world. It's just that it's the underworld that he's attached to.
Well, you seem to be very interested in his interest and his attraction to evil and power.
Well, we all are, I think. We're all attracted to the disreputable. And it counts, I suppose, in part for the tremendous pumping out of stories of criminals, renegades, and the otherwise lawless that we get all the time. There's something atavistic in us that admires rule-breakers, transgressors. The more we ourselves are law-abiding and respectable, the more fiercely burns that little light of sneaking admiration for the truly monumental criminal.
Did you have that sneaking admiration for the criminal when you were growing up?
I suppose I must have, in a kind of fearful way. Of course, in those days, criminals were very much more compartmentalized than they are now. They had their place. They killed each other, and not you. If you just stayed out of their way and you didn't try to compete with them, you were relatively safe and could observe their comings and goings and drownings and killings with some impunity. Now there's some question, some blurring of those lines, I think. It's not quite as clear today in the 1980s who is exactly criminal and who isn't.
Yeah, and so much of the crime is random.
Random crime and also the kind of crime in which ethical standards are not as visible anymore, so that there's a lot of secrecy in this country. We've had occasions of public officials who've been supposed or sworn to uphold the law who have, in fact, broken it. And all that kind of thing just leeches it away. It gives you almost a wish for the good old days when a crook was a crook and everyone else wasn't.
Why did you choose Dutch Schultz as the gangster that the main character in your novel apprentices himself to?
That's an interesting question. I think because he was a New York criminal, and I felt a little more comfortable with him. He was also has a more mythical presence in my mind than some of the others. Dutch Schultz was not his real name, you know. His real name was Arthur Fliegenheimer. But he took the name Dutch Schultz because he was such a tough kid. It was almost given to him as an honor by his gang, because he got through reform school in such a feisty way. So he took on the name Dutch Schultz, which was the name of an earlier criminal in the turn of the century. And the name stuck. He later came to regret it, saying that if he'd kept with his original name, he wouldn't have gotten as much attention and therefore into as much difficulty. But that the name Dutch Schultz fit the headlines as the name Arthur Fliegenheimer couldn't. And so that was his era.
Was he Jewish?
He was.
Did that figure into your selecting him as the main gangster?
No, I don't think so. I think it may have been something as simple as that I liked the sound of the name, the sound Dutch Schultz. It had a kind of a primeval ring in my mind, I think.
Were there stories about him in the Bronx neighborhood where you grew up, or was he reputed to own any businesses or have any front operations there?
Well, Billy is seen early in the book when he goes back to tell about his first connection with Schultz, hanging around one of Dutch Schultz's beer drops, a place, a sort of a warehouse for the awful green beer he was selling or foisting on the speakeasies and then on the bars after the repeal of Prohibition. And the fact that the beer drop is in the neighborhood confers upon the neighborhood a certain kind of distinction, which the young boys like. It gives them a sense of place, a sense of bearing or position in the world that they might not otherwise have. I myself was only 4 years old when Dutch Schultz died. He was killed in 1935. And I don't think any of that actually came through to me. But obviously the name Dutch Schultz and general idea of his rather fast, meteoric, and violent career was part of the folklore of New York in the 1930s.
E.L. Doctorow is my guest, and we're talking about his new novel, Billy Bathgate. One of the central incidents of the new novel is a ritual murder in which one of Schultz's henchmen is killed by getting cement overshoes and getting drowned in the ocean. And you write, a ritual death tampers with the universe. I think this idea of the ritual death was something of great interest to you in planning this novel?
Well, it certainly, the book began with an image in my mind of men in tuxedos in black tie on a tugboat. And for the longest time, I didn't know what it meant or why I was thinking of it. And then I realized that they had to be criminals and that one of them was going to kill the other. And that's really the genesis of the entire book. That's the way it began for me. So this was a crucial scene, a very seminal scene. And the nature of the ritual, the sort of sad necessity of it sort of seeps through the entire occasion and makes it quite horrifying. And I guess something about that appealed to me as a writer.
Let me ask you to read another short excerpt from Billy Bathgate. And this is Billy talking about what it feels like to hold a gun for the first time.
Yes, this comes later. He begins as insinuates himself into the gang, attaches himself to Dutch Schultz, gets his attention, and then becomes kind of mascot, good luck charm, and gradually works his way up into sort of an apprentice kind of person in the gang, and goes beyond that later. But at this point, they're up in the country, and he's given instruction in the firing of a gun, taken to a local police firing range, where Dutch Schultz and his men have set up firing privileges. And Billy says in this point, I will never forget how it felt to hold a loaded gun for the first time and lift it and fire it. The scare of its animate kick up the bone of your arm. You're empowered. There's no question about it. It's an investiture like knighthood. And even though you didn't invent it or design it or tool it, the credit is yours because it's in your hand. You don't even have to know how it works. The credit is all yours. With the slightest squeeze of your finger, a hole appears in a piece of paper 60 feet away. And how can you not be impressed with yourself? How can you not love this coiled and sprung causation? I was awed. I was thrilled. The thing is, guns come alive when you fire them. They move. I hadn't realized that.
Did you go to a shooting range or anything before writing this and hold a gun in your hand so you have a sense of the physical sensation you were trying to describe?
No. No, I don't. I've never fired a pistol. As a soldier in the Army, I fired rifles, which do have a kick. I sort of a different kind. But this, the thing about writing is that, that you use your imagination a good deal of the time and can usually work out things by thinking about them and imagining them. That's the whole game, to get under people's skins, to pretend to be someone you're not, to have experiences you've never had, and to represent them truly, to render them so that questions like this are asked of you.
Several critics who loved your new novel mentioned that in the first person narrative of Billy, who's 15 or 16 in the novel, that he uses some words that it's kind of hard to believe he'd have access to, words like empowered and investiture, which were in the reading that you just gave. How did you think that through, about what kind of language to give him, especially with these like bigger words and more?
Well, I must have understood he was smart as a whip. He's something of a rhapsodist, too. I mean, part of his being is his power to celebrate that, even things even that repel him and make him fearful. He seems to take all of life into himself and embrace it, with a capacity for wonder and rhapsody that is reflected in these nice looping long sentences he comes up with. We do learn at a certain crucial strategic point that Billy has used his criminal earnings to get himself through a very advanced high school in New York called Townsend Harris High School, and then into an Ivy League college, which he decides not to name, because in his adulthood, when he's writing this book, he has a certain renown, and he doesn't want to be identified. He's rather mysterious, as it turns out. And possibly as an alumnus of whatever Ivy League college it is, he doesn't want to pin the rap on them.
Billy Bathgate continues in the tradition, if you'll pardon that word, that you've established in your novels of combining fictional and real historical figures. What is the resonance that you think you can get from a novel by combining those two together?
Well, I don't really know. It's just something that sort of happened. I didn't begin with any aesthetic theory. I think I've since been forced to try to describe or defend this practice many times. I think what I'm doing is dealing with in the case of historically verifiable characters, is I'm dealing with the fictions they themselves made of their lives, the extent that they made themselves public and promulgated a myth about themselves, as Dutch Schultz did, as J.P. Morgan did, as Emma Goldman did in Ragtime. You begin with the fictions people create about themselves, and then they're in your realm, you see, and it's quite valid for you to deal with them and take off from that point.
How did you start doing it? How did the idea first come to you?
I don't know when it came to me or how it came to me. I suppose a good scholar who had the interest and thought it was worthwhile could go back through the books and pick out the first moment where a historical character appears in some kind of fictional guise. I do recall a moment in the book of Daniel where he speculates about the character of Woodrow Wilson, which might have given me this tone of mock historical chronicle that I was able to use in Ragtime. I'm not sure of that, though. It may have been earlier. It's hard to know. You know, it's just as Satchel Paige says. It applies to writers, too. You don't look back.
You know, it's the kind of thing you probably see done badly a lot. You know, even on miniseries, where figures from the past are combined with fictional characters, and you end up with a kind of hodgepodge of history. Do you ever feel that people who do this kind of thing less well point to you as a defense for what they're practicing?
Well, I suppose all's fair in love and art. I mean, I don't feel I have to defend the miniseries.
Uh-huh.
I also know that novelists have been doing this forever. I mean, Napoleon is in War and Peace. Dumas, a great favorite of mine as a boy, the Cardinal Richelieu is a character in, what is it, the Count of Monte Cristo, the Three Musketeers. I mean, it seems to me the point about fiction is it wades right in. It's not a pure form. It's not as pure as music, for instance, which has no words at all. It really mucks about in life. It intrudes in life, in history, and it uses every available kind of data that we have. It uses intuition, it uses fantasy, it uses dream work, it uses history, it uses autobiography. It's all a great big melange of data. And I think the justification for any work is not what theory it uses, but how good the particular book is. I do know that when Ragtime first came out, a lot of people said, well, he can't do this. It's not allowable. Yet writers now sort of routinely base novels on factual historically verifiable figures. Nobody says a thing about it. So maybe this idea of the strict demarcation between the fictional and the non-fictional is breaking down a little bit, which is probably all to the good, because we all compose our lives every day, every minute of the waking and sleeping, and I don't think that fiction writers should be the only ones to take the rap for that.
Most of your fiction has been set in the past. Do you feel that it's not your calling to write too much in the present?
No. I think I'm always writing about the present.
But through the past?
Through the past. But I just may be a little slower than everybody else.
In what?
Well, I'm trying to catch up. You see, I'm running a few decades behind.
Right. Okay. You are still a board member of PEN, the International Writers Organization?
Yes, I am.
Why has it been important for you? You've been outspoken on First Amendment issues in this country and on free speech issues in on behalf of writers in other countries as well. Why has that been important to you?
Well, what is the alternative? The alternative is repression and tyranny and the absence of thought, the absence of life. I think that any writer has to decide at a certain point to commit a certain amount of his time, his effort to this very basic, elementary insistence that such and such a writer shouldn't be in prison, such and such a writer should be allowed back to his own country, such and such a writer shouldn't be tortured, and certainly not have to be in hiding with a death threat on his head. We see all forms of censorship everywhere all around the world. It's really quite appalling, and people who live by the word seem to me to have a certain obligation to simply point this out and say it's wrong.
I'm sure you've asked yourself what, if anything, you as a writer could do to speak out in defense of Salman Rushdie. Do you feel helpless, or that there's something that you can do?
Well, we have done something. Any time our opinion's asked or we're asked to speak about this, we do. We had a really good rally a couple of weeks ago in New York. Thousands of people showed up in the streets trying to get into it. Simply to speak of these things and publicize them is what you must do. I'm beginning to have a little bit of hope for Rushdie in that... as Margaret Atwood pointed out, he's really more valuable now alive than he would be dead in political terms. And this may be an eventual way out through the slow turnings of the diplomatic mills. At least I hope so.
Have you ever been afraid to speak or write your own truth?
You're always afraid. I mean, fear is one of the things you have to deal with. The fear of revelation, the fear of self-exposure, the fear of talking out of turn, the fear of offending those around you who may see themselves in your work. These are all the conditions you begin with. And part of becoming a writer is learning to deal with that fear, learning courage, learning the peculiar life of self-revelation. The interesting thing is that... when you don't have that fear, you don't have, on the other hand, the feeling of transgression that you need to do anything that's really good. So, my God, I shouldn't be saying this. This is really, really breaking a rule here. I'm really doing something I shouldn't do. So when you have that feeling, which is a bit fearful, and that you plod on through, that usually your best work is accomplished.
There's the fear of embarrassment, you know, that you'll write something that won't be liked or that will reveal something about yourself that you won't want revealed. And then the fear of imprisonment, torture, or death. Do you think it's given writers more courage to watch writers in other countries who have to brave so much to just write what it is that they're writing?
Well, we are very privileged here, of course. We're not physically in danger.
Well, actually, weren't you one of the writers who was monitored by the FBI back in the 70s?
Oh, yes, but that was a great honor, you see. That to have a file in the FBI is one of the credentials for achievement. It's like the honor roll of American writing. But essentially, nothing comes of that. And I think they've stopped that now. But it's a great privilege to be on the same list with everyone from Theodore Dreiser and Faulkner and Hemingway and Catherine Ann Porter to all the way up to Truman Capote. I mean, it's a wonderful group of names to be attached to. It's kind of literary criticism the FBI does. I'm talking about like the Czech writer Vaclav Havel, who's just put back in prison on some pretext, or writers in Korea or Indonesia, or even in England now, there's the tendency to constrict, to create more draconian rules of governmental censorship seems to be on the increase. It's rather alarming. But in this country, I think writers are abused mostly by the censoring of their work, the withdrawal of books from school libraries on the local levels. The book becomes an offense to this or that group of individuals, and the rest of the community is deprived of reading it. That's the kind of danger most of us are in this country. On the other hand, we're all aware, I think, now this Rushdie thing has given us sense of the world community of writers as nothing else quite has. And that's extremely valuable, I think.
Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.